Okay, welcome everyone. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the House Committee on Higher Ed and Workforce Development. We have a single item on the agenda right now, which is work session on Senate Bill 1525A. I'm going to open that work session on Senate Bill 1525A, and we have already, staff and committee members, adopted the dash A17 and the dash A19 amendments. Victoria, do you want to do a real brief intro here for us?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1525A grants the Higher Education Coordinating Commission the authority to enter into and administer interstate agreements regarding provision of post-secondary distance education, clarifies the relationship between the HEC and the OEIB, revises composition of the State Board of Higher Ed, prevents faculty and non-faculty staff members of university governing boards from taking part in board discussions relating to collective bargaining, clarifies legislative intent on how constitutional references to the State Board of Higher Ed are interpreted, enables universities with independent governing boards to continue to participate in PERS as they currently do by making those agencies for purposes of PERS, prohibits any faculty or non-faculty staff member of institutional governing board of a university from participating in collective bargaining discussions that affect faculty or non-faculty staff of that university, establishes that notice must be given to governor and the state board of intent to become a university with an independent governing board no later than June 1, 2014. Actually, the amendment we adopted changed that date to May 15, 2014. Clarifies that independent governing boards of technical and regional universities shall take over administrative responsibilities for their universities on July 1, 2015, declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Okay, thank you very much. Rick Gallegos.
Chair Harker, I move to adopt the A-A21 amendments dated February 20th, 2014.
Rick Gallegos moves that we adopt the A-A21 amendments dated February 20th, 2014. We had some discussion on this way back yesterday morning. Is there any discussion today?
Mr. Chair, have we invited some outside testimony to provide clarification?
We have people here who will hopefully provide clarification on questions that are asked, if we want to rephrase them. I did not want to try to have myself rephrase the questions from yesterday because I want to be sure that they are exactly as asked by the people asking them.
And, Mr. Chair, I just want to go on the record. I want everybody to be observant of how powerful I am in getting my members to the committee hearing.
By the way, that's very true. I noticed how powerful you really were.
Yes, sir.
Chair, we're doing A21.
We are.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I've had a lot of advice from LC on this issue. And a lot of help from the Republican office staff, and I've briefly talked to the Oregon Student Association. I still have a lot of questions. I'm not sure. We're talking to the public and the people out there listening. We're talking about voting, registration, tuition, in-state, out-of-state, in this statement that we got late Sunday night or whenever it was. The Republican office staff has tried to help me get some stuff. I still think I'll be a no because I think that we should not do this without coordinating. This is all part of a compact. The amendment dash 21 says that we're participating in the Western Undergraduate Exchange coordinated by the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education, which was done by compact, like an agreement with several states. And so until I see that all those other states agree with what we're proposing here, I'll be a no vote. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Would you like to have any further discussion? Anyone from Secretary of State? Anyone from LC?
No, sir.
No. Rep.
Hoffman, yes. One of the questions I brought up yesterday and concerns that maybe somebody from the Secretary of State's office or somebody in the audience could answer. I was not familiar with the practice of voter registration, where the example I gave yesterday was a student from California where their permanent residence was California. They were up going to an Oregon university, and they could register to vote here. When the Secretary of State's website says that residency is a requirement, If I read that, somehow I could figure out, because I own property in Salem and I pay a lot of taxes here and I wanted to vote for the mayor, I could, and I live here 40% of the time, I could somehow register to vote here also, and then it would be the responsibility of the Secretary of State's office or somebody to figure out if I was committing voter fraud by voting in two different places. And if we don't have a mechanism like that in place to ensure that we don't have students residing here temporarily as students in higher ed, and that they're not getting a ballot in the mail because they're absentee from their state of residence, if we don't have that tracking mechanism in place and going on, then I, even though I know that largely this bill is about something else, the underlying premise being voter registration, I'm not going to be able to support it.
Okay,
thank you. There was a question in there.
Yes, I think there was, and I think I might even know what it is. So maybe Gina, could you come up to help us out on this, if you would? I do want to say that while we have some lively discussion, vigorous debate, some different opinions on things, I think that I speak for everyone here in saying that we do want one person, one vote. And while this is, the issue you raise is not central to the amendment at hand, it is really important, and we do not want people voting in two places as much as we ourselves might like to vote in two places on occasion. So
right.
let's see.
And since it is mentioned in the amendment and an underlying part about the need for or not being registered,
yes,
it's an issue.
So, experts.
Chair Harker, Vice Chair Huffman, my name is Gina Zedlick. I'm Chief of Staff for Secretary Kate Brown, and I have Brenda Bays, Deputy Elections Director, up here with me. And I'll start, and I'll probably hand it to her for the details, but registering to vote, there are requirements, residency, age, that kind of thing, and all of voter registration right now is done by attestation. I say that I'm Gina Zedlick, and I'm not going to portray my age right now and where I live and that I am a citizen, and I attest to all of those things. All of that, if we find evidence to the contrary, is punishable by, is a felony. So you're taking quite a risk if you register to vote and those things are not true. So we do have some different ways of describing residency in our statutes, which we can go into if you like, but that's sort of the umbrella of how it works.
If we could, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I'm the Deputy Director for the Elections Division. The county elections officials, they look at ORS 247.035, which talks about some ways to verify the residence of a voter. If the intent of the registered voter is, this is my home in which I intend to have it, and I intend to return when away, they can consider that their registered address in Oregon, so they could register. And they're stating on the voter registration card that that is true and accurate, and they are attesting to that. Any information provided on the voter registration card that is false, as Gina stated, is a criminal violation.
Okay. Thank you.
Who had the original bill?
I think, yes, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Gina, with this definition of residency, if it's a student-led process, they fill in the blanks, yes, I am a resident, and so forth, within the state of Oregon for voting purposes. This probably isn't your question to answer. Maybe we'll have to call upon our friends at OUS. But if that period of time would be satisfy residency in the state of Oregon, a student who was paying out-of-state tuition when they enrolled in the university should then be eligible for resident Oregon tuition after they've met the residency requirements. Is that correct, would you think?
I would say that that is not correct, that there are different definitions of residency. One is for voting purposes and one is for tuition purposes. And we can pursue that if we want, but that's pretty clear.
Well, different definitions, Mr. Chair, perhaps, but it does seem that there's some incongruities here, things that you either are a resident of the state of Oregon or so that you can vote or you're not. I guess that would be my concern.
Agreed, but that does not track with residency for in-state tuition. Legislative Council?
Is there anyone from OUS here?
Just left.
She's out of here.
Do you want me to get her?
Chair Harker, members of the committee?
That's the issue. I mean, what they're saying about elections is voting is correct, and what they're saying the LC is going to say the residency is a requirement. But we have a compact.
Let's hear from LC, who has, I think, some information to bring to bear.
Chair Harker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gilbert. I'm an attorney at Legislative Council. Yes, as we are discussing, there is a difference between residency for voter registration purposes and residency for the purposes of in-state tuition or being an Oregon resident at an Oregon institution of higher education. This perhaps can best be seen in an OAR 580-010-0031, which is from Oregon for the Oregon University System, in that they set forth a list of potential things that could that are pertinent to determining whether someone is an Oregon resident for the purposes of in-state tuition. These include things like residing in Oregon for 12 consecutive months prior to the beginning of the term for which resident classification is sought. In contrast, the same OAR specifically states that voting or registering to vote is listed among the factors that do not constitute sufficient evidence to affect classification as an Oregon resident. So the result is you will get a certain class of people who are registered to vote in Oregon, but are considered out-of-state residents at Oregon institutions of higher education for tuition purposes.
Thank you very much. And as we discussed the other day, I don't know about in the state of Oregon, but in the state of Michigan and elsewhere, this has been the case for a long time. Students come and register and vote while they are, for other purposes, residents of other states. Same criteria. You're here for school, you can register to vote here. You asked if there were anyone here from the university system. We do have Joe Holliday here. Do you have a question?
If he's familiar with this program, the Western Undergraduate Exchange Program.
Dan, you and I talked briefly about the ability of each state to enter into the compact and make the decisions about how they apply these criteria. Are you comfortable addressing this, or should we call Mr. Holliday?
Chair Harker, it may be best if we call Mr. Holliday
up.
I will say my understanding of the WUWE program is that it is institution-based rather than state-based.
Okay.
That different institutions participate in it.
Thank you. Mr. Holliday? Thank you, Secretary of State.
Chair Harker? Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Holliday. I serve as Assistant Vice Chancellor for Student Success Initiatives with the Oregon University System, and I'm also the Residency Officer for the University System, and I chair our Residency Appeal Committee.
Thank you for being here. Do you want to comment on this particular issue as it's been laid out here? I know you're out of the room for a little bit. Would you like a specific question asked?
Please.
Rep. Wisdom, would you like to do that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. And I apologize to you and the committee. Vice Chancellor Holliday, how many students are we in Oregon schools at this reduced rate right now?
So, Rep. Parker, Rep. Wisnet, members of the committee, are you referring to asking how many students are receiving resident tuition rates versus
the reduced under the Western undergraduate exchange.
Under WUI, right. Mm-hmm. And I may ask Anna Teske to join me because I think she might have those statistics handy. We shared those yesterday. Or
do you have those? Please, Ms. Teske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just for the record, my name is Anna Teske, Academic Policy Analyst and Government Relations Associate for the Oregon University System. Just to clarify the representative's question, you're wondering how many out-of-state students currently participate in Oregon? I do not have that number right in front of me, but I can recall, I think it's roughly 2,700 students or something of that nature. I can definitely send you that information.
Ms. Chair, follow-up?
Of course.
So these 2,700 students are in Oregon going to our universities. Not all of our universities, in case the public doesn't know that. There are certain universities that I don't think University of Oregon or Oregon State participate. They're getting reduced tuition. Because why?
I can answer that. Chair Harker, representative members of the committee, there is a compact of Western states, the Western Interstate Compact or Commission on Higher Education. The Western states have an interstate agreement to discount non-resident tuition rates for residents of their states who attend at public universities in each other state.
Reciprocal agreement.
It's a reciprocal agreement. And two of our legislators, in fact, Senator Devlin and Senator Dembro, are WUI commissioners, as is Hilda Roselli with OEIB. I misspoke. Those two legislators are actually Legislative Advisory Committee members.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know that we send students to these other states, too, and I'm assuming it's sort of matching, because the point of my questions are that we're doing this, sometimes it's because of proximity, a lot of people living on the borders or edges of each of those, and I understand that. But we're giving them a reduced rate than someone that lives and is a resident of Oregon because of this situation. But if they're coming into Oregon and now registering to vote, which to me still indicates a desire to be a citizen, isn't that disadvantaging Oregon students, because we're affecting your bottom line if you're giving reduced rates for this purpose, and the person then says, instead of saying I'm still a Montana resident or Idaho or wherever it is, I'm voting in Oregon, I'm going to be an Oregon resident.
Right. So WUI has a number of programs. WUI is one of those programs, Western Undergraduate Exchange, and it is to enable students to very often to enroll in programs of study that are not available to them in their home state. So it really is an agreement among the states. We're a little bit more of a receiver than we are a sender, I think, for WUI, but it's pretty close. Ideally, it would be about even, but we receive a few more than we send, but not by much.
Okay. One follow-up. One more. So I have the compact. It doesn't go in specifics about this subject, but does the compact, is the way you understand it, if you're doing something that's going to affect other states and they're doing to you, do you have to have agreement by all the states, or can one state unilaterally say, I'm not going to, you can vote in Oregon, but you don't get, you can keep the reduced rates?
Excellent question. I would want to defer that to our WUI commissioners. I don't know how that works, but I do believe it is a consensus of the Western states to do this. So I don't know how an individual state that is within WUI's area would be able to act.
Thank you. And so for the committee, then the Republican staff helped me, went online questions about this program and on the internet. I don't know the authority of it or whatever, but it says, can you establish residency in a state where you're attending school if you're paying the WUI tuition rate? The answer is no. If you want to build time towards establishing residency, it requires you to pay the full non-resident tuition.
I think that comes back to the difference between definition of residency with respect to voting registration and with respect to tuition payment. They are separate, as we have heard delineated in I don't remember the numbers of the OAR.
580.
Yes?
Thank you for your indulgence.
Of course. Is there further discussion on the -821s? Are there any objections? Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Greenlee?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Smith-Warner?
Aye.
Representative Whitman?
No.
Vice Chair Gallegos?
Aye.
Vice Chair Huffman?
No.
Chair Harker?
Aye. The amendments are adopted. Not as uniformly as I always like, but c'est la vie. Thank you for your testimony. Of course. Now, we have another.
Is that, that was the only amendment?
That is the only amendment that we had on here, but there is another one that.
Mr. Chair, out of an earlier conversation we had, there has been a Dash 14 amendment that has been presented to Senate Bill 1525. I understand that we will not act on this amendment, but if it would be okay, I would like to invite Superintendent Mark Tillman up to explain the amendment, to get it on the record, because I think it presents a need that we need to be addressing in the interim in the Education Committee, which I think would be the proper committee for further investigation, and also get it on the record for the task force that is looking into the funding formula and potential change recommendations for the 2015 session out of that. So for those reasons, if we could have Mark come up and explain what he is attempting to do here so that we can maybe give some, you know, get it on the radar screen and make sure we give some guidance to these other groups that are working.
Excellent introduction. Yes, let's please do that. And I understand, sir, that you've driven a little ways here.
Yes.
I apologize that we have limited amount of time, but we are in a little bit of a crunch mode here at this point in the cycle.
I've been here all morning. I totally understand.
Okay.
Finding one of you guys in your office.
All right.
Is no easy task. Real quick, short history lesson.
Identify yourself for the record.
Mark Thielman, ALSEI superintendent. And anyway, this kind of came about. I'm on a couple committees. One is in COSA for open enrollment. My school district's been open enrollment, so I've been up here for a couple of years. So what brought this about, just so everybody has a quick history about it, it really just came out of the inter-district transfer debate that's been going on, which last session they passed an inter-district transfer bill that kind of tied the hands of districts to say to we're no longer allowed to ask if you have an IEP. And it's because what happened fundamentally was that districts were saying yes to inter-district transfer kids and no to special ed kids because of the financial risk of bringing in a high-cost or potentially high-cost person. So when we were really looking at it, it was interesting because this created a debate among superintendents because none of us feel like we get up in the morning to discriminate against anybody. And those things, of course, were levied around. And really what's driving the whole thing is a lack of special education funding. So I'm, you know, just bumbling around in grassroots way, started doing a little homework, and I had conversations over with the finance people at ODE. I've talked to well over 40 superintendents, and most recently at the Salishan Conference. I've talked to a variety of folks that are involved in legislation, including legislators. And I apologize, I probably, in hindsight, should have got this written into a bill. It might have helped. But I was getting divorced, and I was a little distracted. So needless to say, I felt it was important enough to push this, so we're here. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for letting this conversation happen. Just a quick piece of information. There's 74,826 IEP students that are registered in the state of Oregon. Okay, and currently the state funds about 58,000 of those. And the reason that SPED funding, for the way it works, is you get funding from the federal government, and then the state has its own percentage because some districts have more IEP or special education kids than others. Special education kids get what they call a double weight up to a percent cap. So there's 197 school districts. 189 of them have students with IEPs. So we're dealing with 189 school districts that serve students under this classification. Of the 189, 167 students are at or above the funding cap. 84% lose money serving special education kids.
Students or districts?
167 districts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what happens is, this is what creates that issue. If people want to enter district transfer in, and I'm at 17 or 18% IEP, I don't get any extra money to serve that student.
Mm-hmm.
And so some districts say, man, I can't afford it, we're full. The problem is, according to federal rules, you're never full for people within your borders. So it creates a dichotomy. if you live here, you can come to school here. We'll serve you no matter what the cost. If you don't live here, no, we won't take you, but we'll take your sibling if you don't have it, if the sibling doesn't have an IEP. So you can see this is really, it's a real dilemma because we all serve IEP kids, at least 189 of us do. We love them. We want to serve them. So when I did my homework in terms of how we got there, the original law was set up at 11% because that was roughly the statewide average. It's been X number of 30-plus years, and now the statewide average is 13.93%. So the real solution is how do we help districts, especially those that have built strong programs, how do we take away some of the financial risk? And the reason being is because some districts said, well, we're just going to close inter-district transfer because we won't be able to control costs. And that's a legitimate concern. It doesn't make people bad. It makes people concerned. So this is something that we can provide certainty to districts, and we can provide something that they can plan on. I understand that you guys don't want to move on this, but since I'm not a legislature and gave me a few minutes, this is a no-lose scenario for no matter what side of the aisle you're on. This has been well vetted, very well researched. The other piece of this is the high-cost disability piece. If I take a student who's maybe wheelchair-bound or has a traumatic brain injury, what it is I get funding up to the 11% cap, and then I get no funding unless they cost more than $32,000. In LC, we're at 28% and growing. I have two wheelchair-bound kids. You can imagine how much money comes out of my general fund to cover the needs of students. We do our best, but we're not taking them to college here in a Cadillac. We're doing the very best we can, but the stress is there. So we have 40-40-20 and things that we're being asked to do. And this is a win for all districts, even those that are under the cap. For those who are under the cap, increasing the funding up to that average rate, what it does is it provides them protection against changing demographics. For those who are at or above the 11% cap, this gives much-needed financial relief and certainty in funding. What happens to those? They get more funding in special ed on the ed side, special ed side. They can now send funds back to the general fund side. So there's a double win. There's so many wins. I haven't seen too many not wins. The last piece in this amendment, the way it was designed and intended, was to deal with where do we get the extra money from. I don't know if you guys have ever heard that in your line of work. But every year, or every biennium, education costs are factored in for most years, with rare exception, there's a roll-up. So my question to people was, well, where does the 3 or 5 or 7% ed roll-up come from? Well, we just add it in. Okay, we'll add $86 million to that. And that's what this amendment actually does. This would be something that would be passed now. Mm-hmm. It would provide certainty. It would provide a year of vetting. Things could be probed out and worked out. And it's a win-win. And these are the most vulnerable students in our state, and they're the least supported. In particular, they have the least ability to access programs in districts that might be neighboring them that have strong supports and programs for their need. I don't see too many political losers here, and I hate to be crabby, and I do understand the process. Just having an audience is wonderful, but I'd strongly urge you guys to maybe move this. There's the Hail Mary. Mm-hmm. At the very least.
Never hurts to ask.
You know, never hurts to ask. So, are there any questions? If not,
staff.
Oh, by the way, the total cost is $86
million. $86
million. Yeah, and okay. It would double the funding for high-cost disability students.
Okay. I see. Thank you for bringing this matter to our attention. I would like to, the district that I represent is primarily Beaverton School District. I'm going to have a conversation mm-hmm. with Superintendent Rose yeah. there. I suggest that each of us do that. Even though we are the Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee, which is not normally charged with hearing this, I think it would serve us well to be well informed on this. We can't possibly move this right now. But Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you for coming forward. Everything you've said is spot on from my experience. I'm in Hood River County, and you know, the one qualm we've had about open enrollment and opening up some slots is the fear of the unknown, because we're above that threshold, and that happens in districts across the state. So it's, you know, as we try to level the plan, as we try to raise achievement, as we try to take, you know, help make sure everybody's coming into this has a chance at the 40-40-20 and be able to play a role in that, we've got to do everything we can to make sure all students have an equal opportunity, and if they believe that their needs are best met in a neighboring district, they should have that opportunity to go there if that district is willing to receive them. So I'd be happy to work with you in the interim. I know there's other members that likely would too. Love to work with COSA on this. I hope COSA could take an active role in promoting this. So let's keep with it. I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think the distribution formula is meeting this week.
The task force or
yes,
work group, I can't recall.
Yes, sir. And so, Representative Huffman, maybe you and Superintendent can address it at that task force.
Okay, we'll do. Thank you.
I'm planning to testify on other issues.
Certainly very important decisions to be made.
Thank you very much, sir, for
venturing over here and bringing this to our attention.
No problem.
I would entertain a motion about the bill at this point.
Chair Harker, I move that Senate Bill 1525A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Rep. Gallegos moves Senate Bill 1525A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the bill? Rep. Johnson.
Just for clarity, Mr. Chair, which amendments have we adopted to this bill? We
have
it in various work sessions. I would just like to know for
17,
sure.
17, 19, 21.
Yes, sir.
Is
Seven?
It not adopted?
I'm
eight?
Sorry, what?
Amendment 8, was that not dash 8?
No.
Okay.
17, 19, and 21 just
okay.
Today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further discussion.
What's the bill?
Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
No.
Representative Gorsuch. Yes.
Representative Greenlee.
Yes.
Representative
Johnson. Yeah. Representative Smith-Warner.
Aye.
Representative Smith. Aye. Vice Chair Gallegos.
Aye.
Vice Chair Huffman.
Mr. Chair, point of order. Can I let one of my members sink on his own, or do I need to vote with him to...
Yes.
No, you don't have to vote yet. You can vote slowly.
Yes. The motion passes, and the bill is sent to the floor. Rep. Gilliam?
I'll be happy to.
Now, is there anyone here who would like to carry this bill? Seeing no volunteers, we need to assign a carrier at this time. I know, that's what I'm thinking. So, yes, I will carry this bill. And
that's
it. So I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1525A. We have a meeting tomorrow morning at...
No.
We have no meet at a different day.
But
Friday, 9 a.m. Thank you very much.
Oh, really?
What do we got at 9 a.m.?
Friday, did you... 8 a.m.?
No.
Friday, 9 a.m., at least one more announcement here for the good of the order, I know. Rep. Gallegos.
I just want to welcome the PCC folks. If you would stand up. PCC students or faculty or staff or... Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks.
What does that stand for?
PCC. that's Portland Community. Vic,
all
it's
right,
Portland Community College.
Then
is there a topic on Friday?
Warner Pacific.
Subject matter, I'm guessing.
For Friday? I don't remember.
There are two. The HEC is going to give us a presentation on the status of Pay It Forward and also on the status of their investigation into appropriate use of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And accountability there
into what?
In honor of the
And with that, we are adjourned. See you Friday morning at 9.